Well, good afternoon. It's lovely to see so many people here. If it gets a bit too warm, nod to somebody near the back and we'll try and crank open the windows a little more. My name is Mark Lanesmith. I'm the Anglican chaplain to the University of Reading, and it's my delight to welcome you here. This is the second of two lunchtime lectures. About 3 weeks ago, we did How to Be a Bad Christian with Dave Tomlinson. We're doing How to Be an Agnostic. I'm testing my bishop's limits. Next week will be a practical on chicken sacrifice, and you're all very welcome. Ah, the Church of England, push those barriers. It's lovely to see you here. Adverts in advance. If you want to know about future things we're doing, then there's a sign-up sheet, and leave me your email and I'll spam you to heaven and back. Particularly, can I advertise, in January the 16th, we have our Chaplaincy New Year lecture. We have Loretta Minghella, the Director of Christian Aid, is going to come and talk about development, world development, and the good news in the widest sense. And we do hope that will be a large public lecture. That will be in the Henley Business School. Well, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mark Vernon. I bumped into Mark Vernon a couple of weeks ago, about a month and a half ago. But actually, I've read his stuff in The Guardian and in The Tablet and possibly BBC as well, I think. And have been interested with the kinds of things that he was writing. And we just happened to coincide, and I thought I shall nab the chance and ask him, when he's in a position of vulnerability, if he'd come and talk, and he very graciously agreed to do that. He's going to come and talk How to Be an Agnostic, which is a title of a book that he wrote a while ago. He does have some books here, including his most recent one, God, All That Matters. So without further ado, I'll pass over to Mark for about half an hour talk, and then we'll have Q&A for the last 15 minutes. Mark.
Thank you very much, Mark. Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for coming along. I appreciate it. And I do. The question's a bit is serious, actually, so I'm going to try and talk as briefly as I can, really. And then hopefully we'll have a discussion, because, you know, these kind of issues are always better when they're brought out in people's real questions rather than me trying to second-guess where you might be at, as it were. But I did want to talk about this issue of agnosticism, or perhaps better, I think, is the agnostic spirit. Because I think agnosticism is best thought of as a kind of attitude or a stance, a kind of capacity almost, rather than a position. So perhaps up front I need to come out and say that the kind of agnosticism that really interests me is not the almost atheist kind of agnostic. The philosopher Bertrand Russell used to say that he was an atheistically inclined agnostic. And it was a kind of technical point that you could never prove a negative, that God doesn't exist, so strictly speaking he had to be an agnostic, but his stance, as it were, towards life was atheistic. So I'm not really going to talk about that, so I hope you haven't come under false pretenses. I'm really going to talk about the agnostic spirit that's religiously inclined, the religiously inclined agnostic spirit, agnosticism. And in a way, there is a bit of bite to this. This is not just some sort of, at least I hope there will be, this isn't just some kind of, whatever position on religion, the kind of can't make my mind up, but sort of care a bit, but not quite enough kind of argument. I think actually the agnostic spirit really matters in religion and faith. To my mind anyway, one of the main problems with contemporary religious practice is that we've lost touch with the agnostic spirit. And I'll hopefully try and say why I think that's the case by the end. In a way, you might say that synagogues and temples and mosques and churches and so on should be the natural home of this agnostic person, the questing spirit, the person who feels they're onto something but isn't quite sure what. And very sadly, to my mind, it's not really in the modern world. Jokes about the Church of England withstanding. The basic point, I think, is that if God is what you're after, then uncertainty and unknowability is going to become part and parcel of your life. And the reason, I think, is because any claim to know God is really a form of idolatry. And I think it's one of the reasons why idolatry after usury is the big no-no in texts like the Bible. If you, as it were, feel that you've got God, then you haven't, actually. And by definition, I think, what you have is an image of God in your own making. Now, clearly, we all have images of God if we're interested in God at all. But the agnostic spirit is one that's able to hold those provisionally, that's able to recognise that they're pointers, if you like, perhaps symbols that perhaps share in something to do with the divine, but ultimately are only there to be discarded. They're a bit like boats that get you across the water, but you don't then carry the boat on your back for the rest of the journey. It's done its job. So God is unknown. And I think this is very clear in the Bible. When Moses climbs the mountain, he doesn't descend into greater and greater light. He ascends into greater and greater darkness. One of the best bits, if you like, of the New Testament for me is when Paul is talking to the Athenians, and he picks up on this these altars to the unknown God in Athens and uses that as a way to communicate with them. So I think this is very much at the heart, really, of religious traditions, but it's got lost. Again, if you read Augustine's Confessions, there's a very beautiful passage toward the end where he says he knows that he loves God, he desires God, he's questing, he longs for the divine. And yet, what does he love when I love my God, he says? Well, he says, I look at the sky, I look at the trees, I look at the flowers, I look at the beautiful things of life. And they're just sky, they're just trees, they're just flowers, but somehow they speak to me of this unknown God. So this question, in a way, guides his life, I think. What do I love when I love my God? Similarly, if you read Thomas Aquinas, if you're more scholastically minded, agnosticism, the unknownness of God, is the beginning and end of theology for Thomas Aquinas. And when he asks about the so-called five proofs, which are a complete misnomer, the word is way, the five ways that people say they know God as the unmoved mover and so on. He says, well, you know, there's something in these arguments, but they don't really add up. So what have we shown? We've shown that God is a mystery. Our best efforts, as it like, throw us onto the mysteriousness of God, the unknowability of God. We've got to do the work. You've got to, as it were, engage with the ways, so that you've got something to say at all. But the reason for speaking is ultimately to fall into silence. And if you know anything about Thomas Aquinas' life, you'll know that the last period of his life was spent in silence. He had a sort of experience on the 6th of December, 1273, when his secretary came to him at the beginning of the day and said, okay, what's today? Take down his notes. And Aquinas said, enough. I'm not going to speak anymore. And it wasn't a particularly good moment to stop. He was halfway through his Summa Theologiae, but he sort of, as it were, had spoken enough to be able to fall into silence. It's a kind of full, replete unknownness, if you like. We have to talk ourselves out. It's the opposite, if you like, of the whatever, don't really care. So I think it always was central to theology and to faith, to the life of faith, to the experience of being a believer. But it's got lost. And I think we've, as it were, lost the knack, the capacity so much in the modern world. And the difficult thing is that we've lost it for quite good reasons, notably because of the scientific quest, the scientific method, the materialism that lies behind it, the empiricism that lies behind it, has brought great advantages. But certainly in the popular imagination, I don't think this is quite so amongst scientists actually, but certainly in the popular imagination, it's perceived that any useful knowledge delivers certainty, doesn't throw you onto the mystery, doesn't throw you into the uncertainties of life. It should deliver certainties. We feel that might be the case because, of course, science gets converted into technology, and technology does things for us. You know, it helps us to communicate, it helps me get to Reading today. It does do certain things, and we feel the whole of science, perhaps, is not rather like that. I count myself lucky, in a way, for realising that there was more to science than this when I did a physics degree. And my tutor spent his whole life working on dark matter, and Carlos Frenk, and he, outside his study, had a poster when I did physics, which was 25 years ago or something now, 20 years ago, saying, dark matter, does it exist? And I go and see him every so often now, and it still says, dark matter, does it exist, outside his study. He has, as it were, he knows that the life of science is the life of uncertainty. And there's a rather moving personal story behind that too, because he's Mexican, and he grew up in quite a poor part of Mexico, and got into science because he needed some certainty in his life, I think he would say. I think his family situation was such they didn't even know often when food was going to come from. So he went into science seeking certainty, and, you know, as life has this strange way of playing itself back, ends up working on dark matter and in a way becoming reconciled, I think, at a personal level to the uncertainties of life through science. So I think science isn't always like that, particularly when you're in it. And maybe there'd be scientists in the room who would back me up, or perhaps not. But anyway, but nonetheless, at a popular level anyway, and I think largely because of technology, which does do things for us, the kind of product of science, if you like, we've lost touch in the modern world with uncertainty. There's other reasons. I think that the experience of unknowability and uncertainty and mystery and so on is largely an internal experience. It's a felt experience. It takes time to settle into. I mean, I met Mark at a monastery, and I go on retreats very regularly because, for me, there's something about monasteries where the pace of life slows down and you're able to get in touch with something which is more felt and more unknown. And it just seems to me the case that, you know, we practice and train ourselves in the modern world to lose touch with that part of ourselves through distractions. I don't want to sound like some kind of Luddite. I've got my gizmo in my bag like everyone else. But I'm kind of aware and cautious that I can very easily, you know, day in, day out, week in, week out, cultivate habits of mind that lose touch with that, well, I would say deeper sense of reality, if you like, just through constantly going, you know, in the instant. The pulse of life is too quick for it. There's always something, as it were, to grab the mind's attention, rather than slowing down and allowing something to unfold, rather than to be grabbed, you might say. So there'd be social and cultural reasons too. Hoping not to offend anyone too much, but I would take issue as well with a lot of the very strident and vocal forms of religiosity that do the rounds. I know this is a big broad brush sweep because it's not always the case at all. In fact, Dave Tomlinson, who you heard before perhaps, would stand not for this. But certainly there's a very vocal, rather strident form of Christianity, which is the one I know best, and I believe that there's equivalents in Islam and Judaism and so on. That really sell their religion, their religiosity, as delivering certainty. You know, the Bible is read as a book of proofs. The resurrection can be shown and demonstrated. I think it's just a mistake. I think it does actually, I'd go so far as to say, I think it risks idolatry, which I know is a strong thing to say when you're in that world, but I think it does. And that's part of the reason why I feel I want to write these books and try and combat that a bit, you know. There's something slightly ironical about being evangelical about what you don't know about. But nonetheless, I hope you can see there's something in it. How to kind of cultivate this unknownness and this mystery. I've taken a lot, actually, from a book I read fairly recently. It came out a couple of years ago, which has made a big impression on me. And in a way, it's just one way of trying to talk about this. There'll be other ways of trying to talk about it, but it's one way that's particularly powerful. And it's a book called The Master and His Emissary, by a neuroscientist called Ian McGilchrist. And I first noticed this book because he's not only a neuroscientist, he's also a philosopher, a particular historian of ideas. And to my mind, it was one of the first books that was written about neuroscience that was also sort of humanly sophisticated about who we are and about the history of ideas and so on. I had got completely fed up with the kind of neuroscience that says we've discovered the love spot in the brain and all that, you know, collapsing the whole experience of love onto some kind of, you know, hormonal firing or something. I really thought that that neuroscience was just completely ridiculous. Loved by the media, because you get nice pictures of people orgasming while they're, you know, in a brain scanner sort of thing, and the media can't resist that kind of stuff. But more or less worthless, really, unless you're interested in how the brain actually works in a rather medical sense. But for the, you know, the rest of us, if you like, not much use. But Ian McGilchrist's book, The Master and His Emissary, has really changed my mind on that, because he's able to link, I think, sophisticated and subtle notions about what it is to be human to the neuroscience. And the big thing that Ian tries to do in his book is reflect on the two hemispheres and how the two hemispheres are very different, not just in terms of their structure, but in terms of the way that they see the world. The kind of quality of attention they bring to the world, he argues, is very different. He kind of resurrects what knocked around a bit in the 70s, but got rather mushy and sort of ill-defined as kind of left brain and right brain, you know, as if the left brain does the speaking and the right brain does the feeling. And that's not the case at all, and it got ruined because it, There was even a Volvo ad, I think, that even the sort of stuff is a right brain kind of car. You know, I mean, it's a shame. It's a terrible shame. But he argues that really the way to think about it is that the different hemispheres have different qualities of attention. And so the left hemisphere, which of course comes through the right side of the body, if you're right-handed, the left hemisphere is very good at focus, at manipulating things, at drawing maps of the world in order to help you navigate through the world. It feels emotion too, but it's the rather focused, intense kind of emotions like anger. Whereas the right hemisphere, which comes through the left side, that's the sinister side, the left side, is the side that's more open, that actually is better in touch with reality, Ian argues, because it doesn't make maps of the world and then kind of go on the map. It tries to remain open to the world as it actually is. And the point about that kind of attention is that it's far more anxious-making. It's far more... it has to have a much greater capacity to deal with uncertainty, because to be aware of the world as it actually is to be aware of what you don't understand nearly all the time. Ian's book then goes on to argue that, in a way, we've become a culture that's obsessed with the left and has really rather lost touch with the capabilities of the right. And he argues that... is it where we need to reawaken, re-alert ourselves in some way too? Not just to the right, as if the right is better than the left. Although he kind of feels the right is, because the right is open to reality, and then the left helps you process and engage with it. It's got to be, as you were, in that order. But together, this kind of synthesis of consciousness, he argues, opens up. He talks particularly about cultural issues, but he's also talking about spiritual issues too, having been on panels with him and talked to him about it a bit. He believes that, as it were, in the ancient religious traditions, not least monasticism and so on, are practices, a kind of training that, when it goes well, doesn't always go well, but when it goes well, expands one's awareness to utilise both hemispheres, to put it rather crudely. But I hope, again, for the sake of a short talk, you take the point. Generally speaking, I do hope that we're maybe reaching a bit of a turning point, and that the qualities of uncertainty and unknowability, as well as the qualities of certainty and knownness, will perhaps start to appeal to us more. I don't know, I think this does have popular resonance, actually. I often wonder why cosmology is such an easy sell. You know, the vast emptiness of space and, you know, gazing out to other stars and wondering whether ET is there. We've been looking for 50 years, absolutely not a squeak, and yet still it engages us. And I think that part of what that's about at a psychological level is that cosmology, if you like, is one of the ways which we do uncertainty in the modern world. It's partly the fascination with dark matter and dark energy. It's partly the fascination with, you know, is there anyone out there, as it were, staring into the void, if you like. And that's one way we do actually cultivate these things. So I see sort of optimistic signs from my point of view, as well as the rather depressing signs of fundamentalism and scientism and all these other things which do tend to dominate. And I think it matters actually not just for religion. I think that we do live in a world that shows great signs of just not having much agnostic capability. Ability to deal with uncertainty and the unknown. One of the things we did with the BBC was we made a couple of programmes called In Doubt We Trust, which went out on BBC 4, Radio 4, and I think one of them is still online, actually. And we did do kind of science and religion, as you might expect, but also we went to talk to financiers and to politicians. And it's not at all hard to find people who live in those worlds that think that part of the problem is that we've lost the capacity to cope with, to tolerate, if you like, uncertainty. You know, politicians just desperately feel this need to sell certainties. The media, you know, will ridicule you unless you speak in the language of certainty. Now, you know, you and I, in the confines of this, you know, kind of seminar room, would say, well, of course we can cope with uncertainty, of course we can cope with the unknown. But it just doesn't seem quite to get the currency. I think it should in our culture. And these politicians were saying this is one of the reasons why it's got so difficult in politics. Interesting, one of the people said that one of the reasons why he thought Boris Johnson was such an appealing character is that he seems to bumble through uncertainty the whole time and can tolerate it quite happily, you know. And there's something that appeals to us in that. It feels human at last, once again, unlike these sort of rather shiny, polished marketing sorts of politicians we otherwise get. In the financial world too, I believe it's fairly well-established argument now that one of the problems with what happened in 2008 was the sense that we could, as it were, mitigate against all possible futures. So, in effect, uncertainty disappeared through fancy derivatives and security products and so on. And, of course, this wasn't the case. What should have only happened once in every 10,000 years happened actually after about 5 years. This capacity to deal with uncertainty and the unknown. If you're interested in this, John Maynard Keynes is fantastic on all this. He thought that uncertainty should be actually not just at the heart of economics, but at the heart of life. And he gets that from Socrates. Being a good philosopher, he read ancient philosophy, and my PhD was in ancient Greeks. And I think the reason why Socrates is such a seminal figure is that he too had this sense that the unknown side of human life is really what matters. How we negotiate that, how we develop the capacity to think and speak and to tolerate that is really the heart of it. It's not that we don't know anything, but as the skeptics, the ancient skeptics put it, we live, as it were, on the edge of a circle, and inside the circle is what we do know, but outside the circle is what we don't know. And, of course, the point is that the bigger the circle gets, the more that we do know, the bigger our contact with the unknown gets too. And the question is whether we can live on the edge of the circle or not, or whether we rush to the centre and sort of stick our head in the sand of knowing, if you like, and ignore the rest of life. So I think, for me, that's one of the reasons why Socrates is such an appealing character. He, as it were, you know, he's one of these people that didn't write anything, and yet somehow to encounter him was to get a sense of this truer appreciation of what it is to be human. And so you either were drawn to it and try to wrestle with it for the rest of your life, like people like Plato and the skeptics and others did, or you ran in the opposite direction. And of course, eventually Socrates was killed. It's a big ask for many, many, many people, I think. But I think, you know, the religion at its best offers a sort of place, a space to pursue the unknown, to contemplate and the uncertainty of God and of life more generally, of what it is to be human. You know, it offers resources, rituals, discussions, other people too. You know, where one can build up these strengths, I think, and these capacities to deal with what is ultimately unknown, to try and approach God, the unknown God, to ask, what do I love when I love my God? Not can I prove it, but how do I proceed on this way? And I don't suppose you could make this argument add up in any kind of empirical way, but I have this strong feeling, actually, that one of the reasons why we're in such a financial mess, one of the reasons why our politics does seem to be so kind of anxious and desperate and unreal, actually, is because we've lost these spiritual capacities, we've lost these religious capacities in our culture. And I don't know quite how you do it, but I feel that we would be much better off if we could learn to cultivate and nurture them again. You see signs, you know, the cosmology, I think, speaks to that need. There's great interest in things like mindfulness and these kind of practices too, which I find is encouraging. This kind of more slow, patient capacity for, you know, what Keats called negative capability, the not reaching out desperately to grasp, but the allowing in order to unfold and to be. So, I'll finish there perhaps, and I hope that has provoked thoughts and questions and comments, and with luck, you know, we can pick it up in a discussion. Yeah.
My name is David McKnight. I've been Secretary of the Berkshire Human Rights Group, and I've also been involved heavily with the Reading Interfaith Group. Thank you very much for the talk. You said so many things that I would agree with. In fact, I was a science teacher for most of my life, and When I retired and turned to humanism, I decided that they really should appreciate science more than they do. So it's one of my missions, in fact, to turn all humanists into science, into agnostics, really, and to get them to appreciate science. And there are so many ways of dealing with the unknown in science, so many beautiful ways. How do you actually get involved with science to actually, you know, bring this home to yourself? Well, the trouble is that when we go through science education, we actually do other people's science. You know, you are instructed to prove Hooke's law and whatever. Very rarely do you get actual chance to do science yourself, unless for example, you go on a retreat and you really do examine things for yourself and you come to your own conclusions. So that's the way I want to try and turn humanists into agnostics. I mean, there are so many ways of dealing with the unknown, which Christians know well about, and humanists should as well. Like the unknown of how to die. You know, probably one of the most fearful things is how you are going to, you know, pop your clogs. I know how my father went, and I wish I could do that. They just sat in bed and then keeled over. But none of us know how we're going to die. And yet, we can go to hospices. We can go and find out how other people deal with that. So we've got lots of ways. They're not necessarily in a science laboratory. But what you're doing is gathering information from yourself from which you can make your own conclusion about your own future. Leave you with a quick question, because whenever I try to introduce the word agnostic, you always get back sitting on the fence. How do you deal with people who say agnostics are just sitting on the fence?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. The language lets us down, I'm sure. I mean, you give a talk and hope that the word expands in people's minds in the process and doesn't just go back to that. One sort of a rhetorical way of talking about it perhaps is that the word agnostic is actually a modern word. It was invented by T.H. Huxley, Darwin's bulldog. And he was absolutely clear in his writings, for all his ferocity, and he was ferocious, that there are things which we don't know about. And moreover, it's the pursuit of knowledge that shows us these things. And it's not an anti-knowledge position, an anti-scientific position. He thought it's a result of the process of knowledge. And he thought he had to, it was so important, he had to create a word to mark this stance. He wrote a book called, an essay, it may just be called Agnosticism, or might be called What is an Agnostic or something, but anyway, you can find it easily, and he traces in the essay back to people like Socrates and so on, and says this tradition, as it were, is actually strong throughout the human, through the history of ideas. He's very anti-religion and so on. It's not like he's getting cosy to religion in that, but in as much as he's right about what he does with this new word, agnosticism. It just means not knowing, agnosis, you know.
It is a stage in the understanding of the concept, though, to give it a word.
Yeah, as long as the word remains sort of spacious enough, and that I think there is a danger, and if you say, are you an agnostic, it does to most people mean, well, don't really care, whatever, you know, I suppose I'm an atheist, but whatever, yeah, unfortunately. It's not. That's why I try. I hope that the phrase the agnostic spirit it's an attitude towards life, a way of trying to cultivate a certain kind of attention towards things, rather than a settled position in your mind or just not even caring position in your mind.
Every scientist should be an agnostic.
Yeah,
but not always.
No. Yeah, I was just reading a book that just won the Wellcome Trust Prize. Maybe I shouldn't say it because it's slacking off an author or something. I won't say that. Okay.
I'll go on.
No.
I just wanted to throw in the people who are making that comment, which are sitting on the fence,
yeah,
are seeking to. In the context of the talk, it's very interesting to me that what they're seeking by that question is no, come down on one side or the other,
yeah.
Tick this box or that box, be certain about it. And I can't accept you're being uncertain about it.
It's a much more of a spectrum than that. And on both sides of the fence, I sit firmly on the Christian side of the fence. I believe that there is God, but I'm very content that an awful lot about my God I do not know. And so I'm comfortable with a great deal of not knowing. You know, one of the questions I left is, how do I love my God when I know so little about him, as opposed to my wife, whom I know a great deal about, although she's still largely unknowable being. So I think, although there is often that fence between believing that there is God and not believing that there is God, on either side of that cusp, there is a great deal of spectrum through to.
Yeah, I mean it's a nice analogy, I think, about with people, and there's clearly a lot we know about our friends, about partners, and whatever. But I think there has to be a heart that remains unknown, because otherwise the relationship dies, actually. Otherwise, if you felt you really knew someone through and through, it might feel a bit cosy and comfortable for a while, but I think the relationship would have nowhere to go after a period of time, and it would die. And I think, theologically, the way that this is dealt with, in the Christian tradition anyway, is that doctrines like the doctrine of the Trinity, it's not so clear in the West, actually, but in the Eastern tradition, that this is the way the doctrine of the Trinity is interpreted, as far as I understand it, is that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are the ways that we know God. God, as it were, comes to us through history, through liturgy, through conversion, whatever, in these three kind of ways, if you like. But that's known as the economical God, but God in God's essence is unknown, is a mystery. And that is always vital to hold on to. This is the going up the mountain and ascending into darkness, if you like, or the, what do I love when I love my God question, which is part of it. So I think that it's not just that there's some bits I don't know that one day I might discover, a kind of God of the gaps sounding argument. It's actually that the heart of it is this exciting, thrilling, frightening, the unknown is an anxious place to be. I think that's absolutely right. Shouldn't belittle that. But nonetheless, I think it is the heart of things. Yeah, to take 2 points.
Could I just put it to you that I found your talk compelling, and your attitude towards the unknownableness of God, if you will, is very persuasive. Could I put it to you, this is a rather dangerous attitude to strike in the modern age, much more so than it might have been in Thomas Aquinas, because the dominant philosophy, if you like, in the modern age, the small L, is liberalism. Liberalism is all about, as it's called, the small L, is all about individual choice, about people choosing themselves, their lifestyle, the person they want to be. When this comes into contact with the kind of religious system that you describe, you end up with people who sort of pick and choose what they want to believe. They have this sort of portfolio religion of their own. And we lose what I think has been one of the great strengths of religion, organized religion, when it's worked well, which has been shared experience. To give an example, I go to church from time to time, and at every service we turn used to be certain creed. And sometimes I think, well, should I say all of the creed, or should I just say the bits which I'm quite certain I believe? And the bits which I believe change from Sunday to Sunday. And my answer in the end is to say the whole lot. Why? Because it seems arrogant to me to pick and choose in that way. In fact, that seems, if I were to do so, it would be the opposite of the attitude you're describing, which seems to be more humility.
I think you make a very good point, the pick and mix choosing culture, the individualistic choosing culture. Which, again, the trouble is it's brought great strengths, this culture. It wasn't just dish it. It's brought, there are women in this audience, that's part of that culture.
Yes.
So it's brought great strengths.
In a sense, there are two worlds colliding, both of which are individual.
Yeah,
very, very good.
To make the point, I think that I used to go to church, I was a clergyman actually, and then quit, big time atheist, then, eventually tried to find my way to this agnostic position, and part of that was starting to go to church, because I felt that if I was going to take this seriously, this quest, then I need to be part of a community and a tradition that's got more resources, if you like, than just me with my own speculations and thought. And if you're going to have a way of life and not just think of it as something to sort out in your head, then that of necessity involves other people. So that means going, I think, to monasteries and so on, in my case. Anyway, there's different ways of doing it. There'd be the scientific community, perhaps, that might offer some sort of practice and cultivation of these attitudes and so on. But for me, I think that's right. And the business of saying the creed, which is, it's not completely straightforward. But nonetheless, I think there is something about saying, look, this is not a court of law. I'm not being asked to put my hand on the Holy Bible and swear I believe every word of this. I'm opening and exposing myself to one of the richest traditions in human history that's still alive today, that can still does and can still speak to me today. I'm trusting, it's faith, I think, probably, without one sounding too pious. I'm going to go with this one and see where it goes. And not, I have a bit of Buddhism thrown in, like most people do today. I guess I normally choose their lunch and I go to my sitting class, actually. But nonetheless, you know, so it's not closed, it's open as well. But I think you're right about that. There was a point just here and then at the back, yeah.
Is the logical conclusion of this approach to empty yourself of everything you think you know about God until all you've got left? And he's certainly not. Or do you believe that there is something that can be and if
It's a very big question, a very, very good point. I was just reading something the other day which spoke rather nicely to this. It was one religious tradition, I can't remember which one now, and in this tradition it's very common to make a distinction between sort of truths with a small t, which, if you like, is the kind of practical wisdom of everyday life, which isn't just kind of how to do stuff, it is what you presume the world to be.
Operating hypotheses.
Yeah, heuristic devices, whatever. There'd be a range of ways of thinking about these truths of the small t. Like the Archbishop of Canterbury, actually, I've noticed recently he's taken to saying that the creeds are the least embarrassing thing we can say about God, which is a rather nice phrase coming from Williams again, but you see what I mean. And that's, you know, that is to say, it's worth saying. But truth of the capital T is beyond us. That is just what it is to be, as Plato puts it, an in-between creature. You know, we are mortal creatures that get tastes and whiffs of the immortal. We're finite creatures that yearn for the infinite. And that's just to accept what it is to be human, actually. And it's not to ditch the taste of the infinite, the desire for what's immortal, eternal, and so on. And sometimes, you know, maybe you think we get quite a good glimpse of it. If you're a Platonist about mathematics, you might think that mathematics is pretty good effort. But nonetheless, I think that you have to have some kind of distinction, yeah. And so ultimately, I guess, and maybe this is the mystical tradition, would say that these small truth T's are to be discarded, not for the whole of your life, because you can sit and meditate and then you have to go make yourself a cup of tea, you know. Human life is always going to be a mix of the two, but perhaps it can be a mix of the two, in fact. Yeah. There's a question at the back, and then the gentleman here.
Yeah. taking the idea of uncertainty and truths, etc., have you taken any inspiration from the postmodernist school of thought? Because looking at what's happened to that framework, narrative, what do you think the prospects are for your own position?
Mm. I was recently reading a book by Simon Critchley, the New York-based philosopher, British philosopher, and called The Faith of the Faithless, where in a way he tries to say, can certain kinds of postmodern stance, if you like, add up to a kind of faith for otherwise faithless people? Personally, I don't actually buy it. I think that postmodernism is a reaction against the certainties of modernism in certain respects. But what it does in that reactionary stance is ditch the possibility of truth of the capital T. It says it's all just playing around on the surface. And the play makes for an exciting and rich and interesting life, if you like, but grown-up people should ditch the truth of the capital T. That doesn't really make sense to me. I don't think it actually adds up. So I think postmodernism was probably a necessary phase of reacting against some of the more strident certainties of the 19th and, you know, particularly the 19th century, I think. I imagine it's just a phase. I think it isn't. Might be a bit postmodern now. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, that was a bit cheap. But did you say the point?
We're going to have to stop now. But you'll hang around outside if people want
okay,
to.
Okay. Yeah.
We've got a lecturer wanted to come in. I the university's before. It's lovely for you to join us. Can we show appreciation to Mark?
Do you want to read some more?
Mark has some books to sell. Can I beg of you, if you're sat on a seat which is not by a table, could you carry it next door and pop it in the classroom next door? And if you could take all your rubbish out with you. Mark will be around outside of this classroom if you want to carry on the conversation.
That's all right. No. It's great. Yeah.